Side 8, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter. Continuing on page 311. Alexander stepped forward, shadowed by his guards. He walked past the eroded foundations of vanished buildings and reached a set of steps that led up to what had once been a temple. Alexander was visibly shaking as he climbed these worn steps. He reached a bare, dusty platform and knelt down, his head bowed. Eumenes murmured, "When we were here, this place was ancient, but not ruined. The god Ammon came riding out in his sacred boat, borne aloft by purified bearers, and virgins sang songs of divinity. The king went through to the holiest shrine of all, a tiny room roofed by palm trunks, where he consulted the oracle. He never revealed the questions he asked, not even to me, not even to Hephaestion. And it was here that Alexander realized his divinity."
Isessa knew the story. During Alexander's first pilgrimage, the Macedonians had identified the ram-headed Libyan god Ammon with the Greek Zeus. And Alexander had learned that Zeus, Ammon, was his true father, not King Philip of Macedon. From this point, he would take Ammon to his heart for the rest of his life. The king seemed crushed. Perhaps he had hoped to find that the shrine had somehow survived the discontinuity, that this place, most sacred of all to him, might have been spared. But it was not so, and he had found nothing here but the dead weight of time. Isessa murmured to Eumenes, "Tell him it wasn't always like this. Tell him that 9 centuries later, when this place was part of the Roman Empire, and Christianity was the empire's official religion, there would still be a group of adherents here at this oasis, still worshipping Zeus Ammon and Alexander himself."
Eumenes nodded gravely and in measured tones delivered this news from the future. The king replied, and Eumenes returned to Bessessa. "He says that even a god cannot conquer time, but 900 years should be enough for anybody." The party stayed a day at the oasis to recuperate and water the camels, and then returned to the shore. 42. Last Night. A week after their return to Babylon, Bessessa announced she believed the Eye of Marduk would send her home. This was met with general incredulity, even from her closest companions. She sensed that Abdikadir thought this was no more than wishful thinking, that her impressions of the Eye and the entities beyond it might be fantasy, that all of this was no more than what she wanted to believe. Alexander, though, faced her with a simple question. "Why you?"
"Because I asked it to," she said simply.
And he thought that over, nodded, and let her go. Skeptical or not, her companions, modern, British, and Macedonian, accepted her sincerity and supported her preparations for her departure, such as they were. They even accepted the date she announced for going. She still had no proof of any of this and couldn't even be sure if she was interpreting her inchoate impressions of the Eye correctly. But everyone took her seriously, and she was flattered by that, even if some of them gloated a little about how stupid she was going to look if the Eye let her down. As the last day approached, Bessessa sat with Josh in the chamber of Marduk with the looming, silent Eye hanging over them. They clung to each other. They were beyond passion. They had made love in defiance of the Eye's cold glare. But even that could not drive the Eye out of their consciousness. All they wanted now, all they could ask of each other, was comfort. Josh whispered, "Do you think they care at all about what they have done? The world they have taken apart? Those who have died?"
"No. Oh, perhaps they have a certain academic interest in such emotions. Nothing beyond that."
"Then they are less than me. If I see an animal killed, I am capable of caring for it, of feeling its pain."
"Yes," she said patiently, "but Josh, you don't care for the millions of bacteria that die in your gut every second. We aren't bacteria. We are complex, independent, conscious creatures. But they are so far above us that we are diminished to nothing."
"Then why would they send you home?"
"I don't know. Because it amuses them, I suppose." He glowered at her.
"What they want doesn't matter. Are you sure this is what you want, Bessessa? Even if you do go home, what if Myra doesn't want you?"
She turned to look at him. His eyes were huge in the lamplight gloom. His skin very smooth, young-looking. That's ridiculous.
Is it? Bessessa, who are you? Who is she? After the discontinuity, we are all fractured cells that straddle worlds. Perhaps some splinter of you could be given back to some splinter of Myra.
Resentment exploded in her as her complicated feelings for both Myra and Josh came bubbling up.
You don't know what you're talking about.
He sighed.
You can't go back, Bessessa. It would mean nothing. Stay here.
He grabbed her hands.
We have houses to build, crops to grow, and children to raise. Stay here with me, Bessessa, and have my children. This world is no longer some alien artifact. It is our home.
Suddenly she softened.
Oh, Josh. She pulled him to her. Dear Josh, I want to stay, believe me, I do. But I can't. It's not just Myra. This is an opportunity, Josh. An opportunity they haven't offered to anybody else. Whatever their motives, I have to take it. Why? Because of what I might learn. About why this has happened. About them. About what we might do about all this in the future.
Ah, he smiled wistfully. I should have known. I can argue with a mother about her love for her child. But I can't stand in the way of a soldier's duty.
Oh, Josh, take me with you.
She sat back, shocked.
I wasn't expecting that. Bessessa, you are everything to me. I don't want to stay here without you. I want to follow you, wherever you go.
But I may be killed, she said softly.
If I die by your side, I will die happy. What else is life for?
Josh, I don't know what to say.
All I do is hurt you.
No, he said gently. Myra is always there. If not between us, then at your side.
I understand that. Well, even so, nobody loved me this way before.
They embraced again and were silent for a while. Then he said, you know, they don't have a name.
Who?
The baleful intelligences who engineered all this.
They are not God. Are any gods?
No, she said. She closed her eyes. She could feel them even now like a breeze from the heart of an old dying wood, dry and rustling and laden with decay.
They are not gods. They are of this universe. They were born of it, as we were. But they are old, terribly old, old beyond our imagining.
They have lived too long, perhaps. And that is what we will call them. He looked up at the eye, chin jutting, defiant. The firstborn, and may they rot in hell. To celebrate Bessessa's peculiar departure, Alexander ordered an immense feast. It lasted 3 days and three nights. There were athletic contests, horse races, dances, and music, and even an immense battue in the Mongol style, the tales of which had impressed even Alexander the Great. On the last night, Bessessa and Josh were guests of honor at a lavish banquet in Alexander's commandeered palace. The king himself did her the honor of dressing like Ammon, his father god, in slippers, horns, and purple cloak. It was a violent, noisy, drunken affair, like the ultimate rugby club outing. By 3 a.m., the booze had polished off poor Josh, who had to be carried out to a bedroom by Alexander's chamberlains. Illuminated by a single oil lamp, Bessessa, Abdikadir, and Casey sat close to each other on expensive couches, a small fire burning in a hearth between them. Casey was drinking from a tall glass beaker. He held it out to Bessessa.
Babylonian wine. Better than that Macedonian rot gut. You want some?
She smiled and passed.
I think I ought to be sober tomorrow.
Casey grunted.
From what I hear of Josh, one of you needs to be.
Abdikadir said,
so here we are, the last survivors of the 21st century. I can't remember the last time the three of us were alone.
Casey said,
not since the day of the chopper crash.
That's how you think of it? Bessessa asked. Not the day the world came apart at the seams, but the day we lost the bird.
Casey shrugged.
I'm a professional. I lost my ship.
She nodded.
You're a good man, Casey. Give me that stuff.
She grabbed the beaker from him and took a draught of wine. It was rich, tasting very old, almost stale, the produce of a mature vineyard. Abdikadir was watching her, his blue eyes bright.
Josh spoke to me this evening,
before he got too drunk to speak at all. He thinks you are keeping back something from him, even now. Something about the eye.
I don't always know what to tell him, she said. He's a man of the 19th century.
Christ, he's so young.
Well, he's not a child, Biss, Casey said. Men no older than him died for us facing the Mongols. And you know he is prepared to give up his life for you.
I know.
So, Abdelkadir said, what is it you won't tell him?
My worst suspicions.
About what?
About facts that have been staring us in the face since day one. Guys, our little bit of Afghanistan, and the slab of sky above it, that preserved the Soyuz, is all that came through the discontinuity from our own time. And hard as we've looked, we've found nothing from any era later than our own. We were the last to be sampled. Doesn't that seem strange to you? Why would a 2-million-year history project end with us?
Abdelkadir nodded. Ah, because we are the last. After us, there is nothing to be sampled. Ours was the last year, the last month, even the last day.
I think, Assessor said slowly, that something terrible must happen on that final day. Terrible for humanity, for the world. Maybe that's why we shouldn't worry about time paradoxes, going back and changing history. Because after us, Earth has run out of history to change.
Abdelkadir said, and perhaps this answers a question that occurred to me when you described your ideas on space-time rips. It would surely take a stupendous amount of energy to take space-time apart like that. Is that what faces the Earth?
He waved his hands. Some immense catastrophe, a great outpouring of energy, in the face of which Earth is like a snowflake in a furnace, an energy storm that disrupts space and time itself.
Casey closed his eyes and drank more wine.
Christ, Biss, I know you'd bring the mood down.
And maybe that's why the sampling happened in the first place, Abdelkadir said.
She hadn't thought it through that far.
What do you mean? The library is about to burn down. What do you do about it? You run through the galleries, grabbing what you can. Maybe the construction of Mir is an exercise in salvage?
Casey said, eyes still closed.
Or looting.
What?
Maybe these firstborn are just here to record the end. Maybe they caused it. I bet you hadn't thought of that either, Biss.
Abdelkadir said, why couldn't you tell Josh this?
Because he's full of hope. I couldn't crush that.
They sat in tense, brooding silence for a while. Then they started to talk about their future plans.
Abdelkadir said, I think Eumenes sees me as a useful tool in his endless quest to distract the king. I proposed an expedition to the source of the Nile. The firstborn seem to have preserved fragments of humanity, perhaps from the first divergence from the chimps. But what were the very first? What quality about those deepest, hairiest ancestors did the firstborn recognize as human? That's the prize I want to dangle before Alexander.
It's a fine ambition, the assessor said.
Privately, though, she doubted if Alexander would be sold on it. It was Alexander's worldview that was going to shape the near future. And that was a dream of heroes, gods, and myths, not a quest for resolving scientific questions.
I have a feeling you will find a place wherever you go, Abdi.
He smiled.
I have always inclined to the Sufi tradition, I think. The inner exploration of faith. Where I am doesn't matter.
I wish I felt the same, she said earnestly.
Casey said, as for me, I don't want to live out my life in a James Watt theme park. I'm trying to kickstart other industries. Electricity, even electronics, maybe.
What he means, Abdelkadir said dryly, is that he's becoming a schoolteacher.
Casey squirmed a little, but he tapped his broad cranium.
Just want to make sure that what's up here doesn't die when I do, so generations of poor saps have to rediscover it all.
Assessor squeezed his arm.
It's okay, Case. I think you'll be a good teacher. I always did think of you as a surrogate father.
Casey's swearing in English, Greek, and even Mongolian was impressive. Miss Esser stood. Guys, I hate to say it, but I think I should get some sleep. With one instinct, they pulled together and wrapped their arms around each other, heads together, huddling like players in a football game. Casey said, "You need a blue bomber?" "I have one." "One more thing," Miss Esser whispered. "Let the man-apes go. If I can break out of the cage, so should they." Casey said, "I promise." "No goodbyes, Biss." No goodbyes." Abdegadir said, "Why is life given to be thus wrested from us?" Casey grunted. "Milton, paradise lost, right? Satan's challenge to God." Miss Esser said, "You never cease to amaze me, Case. The firstborn are no gods." She grinned coldly. "But I always admired Satan." "Fuck that," said Casey. "The firstborn have to be stopped." After a final long moment, she pulled away and left them with their wine. Miss Esser sought out Eumenes and asked permission to leave the banquet. Eumenes was upright, contained, and apparently sober. He said in his stilted, heavily accented English, "Very well. But, madam, only on condition I am allowed to accompany you for a while." With a few guards, they walked up Babylon's ceremonial way. They called to the townhouse commandeered by Captain Grove. Grove embraced her and wished her luck in his clipped, Noel Coward accent. Miss Esser and Eumenes walked on out of the city walls through the Ishtar Gate and into the tent city of the army beyond. The night was clear and cold, with the unfamiliar stars and a bony crescent moon showing through high, yellowish clouds. When Miss Esser was recognized, she was greeted with cries and waves. The troops and their followers had been given gifts of wine and meat by the king in Miss Esser's honor. The whole camp seemed to be awake. The tents glowed from lamps lit inside, and music and laughter rose up like smoke. "They are all sorry to see you go," Eumenes murmured. "I just gave them an excuse for a party." "You should not, underestimate your contribution. We were all pitched together into this fractured new world. There was great suspicion, even incomprehension, between our various parties. And the three of you from the 21st century were the fewest and most isolated of all. But without you to help us, even Alexander's wiles might not have prevailed against the Mongols. We have become an unlikely family."
"Yes, we have, haven't we? I suppose that says something about enduring qualities of the human spirit."
"Yes."
He stopped and faced her, and his expression showed the grim anger she had seen in him before.
"And where you are going as you face an enemy even Alexander could not challenge. You must call on those same qualities again, on behalf of us all."
A nursing mother, the wife of a soldier, sat on a low stool outside one of the tents, her baby at her breast. The baby's face was a pale disk, like the moon. The mother saw the Sessa watching and smiled. Eumenes said, "The Babylonian astronomers have decided that the discontinuity should be considered the start of a new calendar, a new year. Indeed, the start of one of their mighty cycles, their great years. Everything began afresh that day. And the first babies to be conceived on Mir have already been born. They did not exist in whatever world we came from. They could not have, or some of their parents came from different eras. But their past is not fractured like ours. They only exist here. I wonder what they will do when they grow up." She studied his face, its tan planes shadowed in the uncertain light.
"You understand so much," she said.
He grinned disarmingly.
"As Casey says, like all ancient Greeks, I'm smart as a tack and smug with it. What do you expect?"
They embraced stiffly. Then they walked back to the city. 43. The Eye of Marduk. When Miss Esser arrived in the Temple of Marduk the following morning, Abdelkadir was waiting and Casey was already working, checking out sensor equipment. They were here for her. She was touched by their faith in her and reassured by their competence. The eye floated impassively, as it always did. Josh was here. While Miss Esser was wearing her flight suit, much patched, Josh wore a rumpled flannel suit and shirt, and, absurdly enough, a tie. but she thought they had no idea what they would face today. Why not look your best? But his face was white, and there were deep shadows under his eyes. Into infinity with a sore head. At least I can't be made to feel any worse, whatever happens. Professor felt oddly impatient, irritable. Let's get on with it, she said. Here. She held out a small backpack. He looked at it dubiously. What's in it? Water, dried rations, some medical supplies. You think we won't need this? Professor, we are entering the eye of Marduk, not hiking across the desert. But she's right, Abdikadir snapped. Why not anticipate what we can? He took the bag and thrust it at Josh. Take it. Professor said to Josh, and if you're going to grouse all the way, I'll leave you behind. Josh's pained face crumpled into a smile. I'll be good. Professor looked around. I told Eumenes and Grove to keep everybody else away. I'd have preferred them to evacuate the damn city, but I suppose that wasn't practical. Is there anything we've forgotten? She had used the bathroom, cleaned her teeth. Simple human actions, but she wondered where, when she would next have time to groom herself. Abdi, take care of my phone. Abdikadir said gently, as I promised. And one more thing. He held out two pieces of paper, Babylonian parchment, neatly folded and sealed. If you don't mind, from you, me and Casey. If it's possible, if you can find our families. Professor took the papers and tucked them inside her jumpsuit. I'll make sure they get them. Casey nodded. Then he called. Something's happening. He adjusted his headset and tapped an electromagnetic sensor lashed up from the guts of the chopper's ruined radio. He glanced up at the eye. I don't see any change in that thing, but the signal's intensifying. It seems somebody is expecting you, Professor. Professor took Josh's hand. We'd better take our positions. Where? A lock of hair on his forehead was ruffled by a breeze. Damned if I know, she said. Finally, she tucked back his hair, but the breeze came again, washing over Josh's face, a breeze that blew in from no apparent source toward the center of the chamber. It's the eye, Abdikadir said. Bits of paper and loose cabling fluttered around him. It is breathing in. Isessa, get ready. The breeze had become a wind, flowing toward the center of the room, strong enough to buffet Bessessa's back. She pulled Josh with her and stumbled toward the eye. It hung there as still as ever, returning her own distorted voodoo doll reflection. But bits of paper and straw flew up and clung to its surface. Casey threw his headphones aside. Shit! There was a shriek. An electromagnetic chirp. It's blown the circuit. Whoever that thing is signaling, it isn't me. It's time, Josh said. So it was, she thought. On some deep level, she hadn't believed it herself. But now it was happening. Her stomach fluttered, her heart pounded. She was profoundly grateful for the feel of Josh's strong hand. Look up, Abdikadir said. For the first time since they had found it, the eye was changing. The reflective sheen was still there, but now it oscillated like the surface of a pool of mercury, waves and ripples chasing across its surface. Then the surface collapsed, like the skin of a suddenly deflated balloon. Nessessa found herself looking up into a funnel walled with a silvery gold. She could still see reflections of herself with Josh at her side, but their images were broken up, as if scattered from the shards of a smashed mirror. The funnel seemed to be directly before her face, but she guessed that if she were to walk around the chamber or climb above and below the eye, she would see the same funnel shape, the walls of light drawing in toward its center. This was not a funnel, no simple three-dimensional object, but a flaw in her reality. She looked over her shoulder. The air was full of sparks now, all rushing toward the core of the imploded eye. Abdikadir was still there, though he seemed to be drawing more distant, and he was oddly blurred. He was clinging to the door frame, and he was on the ground, and he turned away and turned back, not sequentially, but all at the same time, like the frames of a movie reel cut out and reassembled in a random order. "Go with Allah," he called. "Go, go!" But his voice was lost on the wind. And then the storm of light grew to a blizzard, and she could see him no more.
The wind tugged at her, nearly knocking her off her feet. She tried to be analytical. She tried to count her breaths, but her thoughts seemed to fragment, the inner sentences she formed breaking into words and syllables and letters jumbling into nonsense. It was the discontinuity, she thought. It had worked on the scale of a planet, cutting adrift great slabs of landscape. But it had broken into this room, cutting Abdelkader's life into pieces. And now, at last, it was pushing into her own head, for after all, even her consciousness was embedded in space-time. She looked into the eye. The light was streaming into its heart. In these final moments, the eye changed again. The funnel shape opened out into a straight-walled shaft that receded to infinity. But it was a shaft that defied perspective, for its walls did not diminish with distance, but stayed the same apparent size. It was her last conscious thought before the light washed down over her, filling her, searing away even her sense of her body. Space was gone, time itself suspended, and she became a mote, nothing but an animal's bright, stubborn, mindless soul. But through it all, she was aware of Josh's warm hand in hers. There was only one eye, though it had many projections into space-time, and it had many functions. One of those was to serve as a gate. The gate opened. The gate closed. In a moment of time, too short to be measured, space opened and turned on itself. Then the eye vanished. The temple chamber was left empty, save for a tangle of ruined electronic gear, and two men with memories of what they had seen and heard, memories they could neither believe nor understand. Part 6. Time's Eye. 44. Firstborn. The long wait was ending. On yet another world, intelligence had been born and was escaping from its planetary cradle. Those who had watched Earth for so long had never been remotely human, but they had once been flesh and blood. They had been born on a planet of one of the first stars of all, a roaring, hydrogen-fat monster, a beacon in a universe still dark. These first ones were vigorous in a young and energy-fat universe. But planets, the crucibles of life, were scarce, for the heavy elements that comprised them had yet to be manufactured in the hearts of stars. When they looked out across the depths of space, they saw nothing like themselves, no mind to mirror their own. The early stars blazed gloriously but died quickly. Their thin debris enriched the pooled gases of the galaxy, and soon a new generation of long-lived stars would emerge. But to those left stranded between the dying protostars, it was a terrible abandonment. And as they looked ahead, they saw only a slow darkening, as each generation of stars was built with increasing difficulty from the debris of the last. There would come a day when there wasn't enough fuel in the galaxy to manufacture a single new star, and the last light flickered and died. Even after that, it would go on, the terrible clamp of entropy strangling the cosmos and all its processes. Despite all their powers, they were not beyond the reach of time. This desolating realization caused an age of madness. Strange and beautiful empires rose and fell, and terrible wars were fought between beings of metal and of flesh, children of the same forgotten world. The wars expended an unforgivable proportion of the galaxy's usable energy reserve, and had no resolution but exhaustion. Saddened but wiser, the survivors began to plan for an inevitable future, an endless future of cold and dark. They returned to their abandoned machines of war. The ancient machines were directed to a new objective, to the elimination of waste, to cauterization if necessary. Their makers saw now that if even a single thread of awareness was to be passed to the furthest future, there must be no unnecessary disturbance, no wasted energy, no ripples in the stream of time. The machines had been honed by a million years of war. They fulfilled their task perfectly, and would do so forever. They waited, unchanging, dedicated to a single purpose, as new worlds and new life congealed from the rubble of the old. It was all for the best of intentions. The first ones, born into an empty universe, cherished life above all else. But to preserve life, life must sometimes be destroyed. 45. Through the Eye. It wasn't like waking. It was a sudden emergence, a clash of symbols. Her eyes gaped wide open and were filled with dazzling light,
She dragged deep breaths into her lungs and scrabbled at the ground and gasped with the shock of selfhood. She was on her back. There was something enormously bright above her. The sun, yes, the sun. She was outdoors. Her arms were spread out wide, away from her body, and her fingers were digging into the dirt. She threw herself over onto her belly. Sensations returned to her legs, arms, chest. Dazzled by the sun, she could barely see. A plain, red sand. Eroded hills in the distance. Even the sky looked red, though the sun was high. Josh was beside her. He was lying on his back, gasping for air like an ungainly fish stranded on this strange beach. She scrabbled over to him, crawling through loose sand.
"Where are we?"
he gasped.
"Is this the 21st century?"
"I hope not." When she tried to speak, her throat was dry, scratchy. She pulled her pack off her back and dug out a flask of water.
"Drink this."
He gulped at the water gratefully. Sweat was already standing out on his brow and soaking into his collar. She dug her hands into the dirt. It crumbled, pale, lifeless, and dry. But something shone in it, fragments that glittered when exposed to the overhead sun. She dug them out and laid them on her palm. They were coin-sized fragments of glass, opaque, their edges ragged. She shook the fragments out of her palm and let them fall to the ground. But when she brushed away more dirt, she found more glass bits everywhere, a layer of the stuff beneath the ground. Experimentally, she pushed herself to her knees, straightened up. Her ears rang with dizziness, but she wasn't going to faint. And then, one foot, two, she stood up. Now she could see the landscape better. It was just a plain of this glass-ridden sand that marched away to the horizon, where worn hills waited out eternity. She and Josh were at the base of a shallow depression. The land subtly rose all around them to a rim, no more than a few meters high, perhaps a kilometer away. She was standing in a crater. A nuke would do this, she thought. The glass fragments could have been formed in the explosion of a small nuclear weapon, bits of concrete and soil fused to glass. If that was so, nothing else was left. If there had been a city here, there were no concrete foundations, no bones, not even the ashes of the final fires, only the fragments of nuclear glass. This crater looked old, worn, the bits of glass buried deep. If war had come by here, it must have been long ago. She wondered if radioactivity lingered. But if the firstborn had meant her any harm, they could have simply killed her. And if not, surely they would protect her from such an elementary hazard. Her chest ached as she breathed. Was the air thin? Was there too little oxygen, or too much? Suddenly it got a little darker, though there was no cloud in the ruddy sky. She peered up. There was something wrong with the sun. Its disk was deformed. It looked like a leaf out of which a great bite had been taken. Josh was standing beside her.
"My God," he said.
The eclipse progressed quickly. It began to feel colder, and in the last moments, Bessessa glimpsed bands of shadow rushing across the eroded ground. She felt her breathing slow, her heart pump more gently. Her body, responding even now to ancient primal rhythms, was reacting to the darkness, readying itself for night. The darkness reached its greatest depth. There was a moment of profound stillness. The sun turned to a ring of brightness. The central disk of shadow had a serrated edge, and sunlight twinkled through those irregularities. That disk was surely the moon, still traveling between earth and sun, its shadow sliding across the face of the sun. The sun's glare was reduced enough for Bessessa to make out the corona, the sun's higher atmosphere, easily visible as a wispy sculpture around that complex double disk. But this eclipse was not total. The moon was not big enough to obscure that glowing face. The fat ring of light in the sky was a baffling, terrifying sight.
"Something's wrong," Josh murmured.
"Geometry," she said.
"The Earth-Moon system. It changes with time."
As the moon dragged tides through Earth's ocean, so Earth likewise tugged at the moon's rocky substrate. Since their formation, the twin worlds had slowly separated. Only a few centimeters per year, but over enough time that took the moon ever farther from the Earth. Josh understood the essence of what had happened.
This is the future. Not the 21st century. The very far future. Millions of years hence, perhaps.
She walked around the plain, peering up at the complex sky.
You're trying to tell us something, aren't you? This desolate, war-shattered ground. Where am I? London? New York? Moscow? Beijing? Lahore? And why bring us to this precise place and time to show us an eclipse? Has all this got something to do with the sun?
Hot, dusty, thirsty, disoriented, she was suddenly filled with rage.
Don't give me special effect riddles. Talk to me, damn you. What's going to happen?
As if in reply, an eye, at least as large as the eye of Marduk, snapped into existence above her head. She actually felt the wash of the air it displaced as it forced its way into her reality. She took Josh's hand.
Here we go again. Keep your hands inside the car at all times.
But his eyes were wide. Sand clung to his sweat-streaked face.
Assessor?
She understood immediately.
He couldn't see the eye.
This time it had come for her. Her alone, not for Josh.
No!
She grabbed Josh's arm.
You can't do this, you cruel bastards!
Josh understood.
Assessor, it's all right.
He touched her chin, turned her face toward him, kissed her mouth.
We've already come further than I could have dreamed possible. Perhaps our love will live on in some other world. And perhaps when all possibilities are drawn together at the end of time, we will be reunited.
He smiled.
It's enough.
In the sky, the eye flipped into a funnel shape, and then a corridor in the sky. Already sparks of light were rushing across the plain, gathering around her, hurtling upward. She clung to Josh and closed her eyes.
Listen to me. I've done everything you've asked. Give me this one thing. Don't leave him here to die alone. Send him home. Send him back to Abdi. This one thing, I beg you.
A hot wind gathered, rushing up from the ground into the mouth of the shining shaft overhead. Something tugged at her, pulling her from Josh's arms. She struggled, but Josh let go. She was lifted off the ground. She was actually looking down at him. He was still smiling.
You are an angel ascending. Goodbye, goodbye.
The searing, beautiful light gathered around her again. In the last instant, she saw him stagger back into a room crowded with wires and bits of electronic gear, where a dark man rushed forward to catch him.
Thank you.
A clash of symbols. 46. Grasper. With the coming of the morning, Seeker woke with a start, eyes snapping open. For the first time in years, there was no net sheltering her from the sky. She cried out and curled over her daughter. She forced open one eye. There was still no net, nothing but bare ground around her, a few scuff marks and tracks. The soldiers had gone. They had taken away the cage. She was free. She sat up. Grasper woke up with a grumble and rubbed her eyes. Seeker looked around. The rocky plain swept away, bare of life, save for a few tussocks of grass. In the distance, snow-capped mountains loomed over the horizon, blue and floating in the morning mist. Near the base of the mountains, she made out a stripe of green. Her old spirit stirred.
Forest. If they could make it that far, perhaps she would find others like herself.
But the breeze changed, coming from the north, and she tasted ice. She quailed. Suddenly she longed for the smells of cooking, the clattering of machines, the high, gull-like voices of the soldiers. She had spent too long in her cage. She missed it. Grasper, though, shared none of her mother's hesitation. She knuckle-walked forward, chimp-like, exploring the rocky ground. It seemed rich in texture compared to the swept, bare, stamped-down dirt floor of the cage. Here was a rock that fit neatly in her hand, there a dry reed that folded and bent and twisted with ease. Clutching the rock, Grasper unfolded her legs and stood upright. She peered across the broken ground toward the mountains and the ice. In the north, the cold was gathering. A new volcanic island in the Atlantic had deflected the Gulf Stream. The flow of southern water that had kept northern Europe anomalously warm for millennia. The Gulf Stream's loss had already had impacts on agriculture as far south as Babylonia. Now it was going to get worse. This year, autumn would come early, and by midwinter, massive Arctic superstorms would erupt with fury over the continents, depositing more snow in a few days than would once have been seen in 5 or 10 years.
For 2 million years before the discontinuity, the ice had come and gone from its fastnesses at the poles, its complex cycles governed by subtleties of Earth's passage around the sun. This new world, Mir, thrown together from fragments of the old, had at first oscillated unsteadily. But as that first motion damped, it was settling down to a new pattern of cycles, a pattern that in the short term promoted the spreading of the ice. It would take only a decade for the ice caps to form, a decade more for them to extend as far south as the sites of London, Berlin, Manhattan. Further ahead, even more drastic changes were to come. Since its formation, the planet had been steadily cooling, and the flow of heat from its interior had driven the mantle currents on which the continents rode. Now the discontinuity had caused disturbances in the deep, strange weather of Mir's liquid interior. Eventually, a new pattern of currents would settle into place. But for now, it was as if a vast lid had been clamped on a boiling pan. Beneath the hearts of the continents, the mantle material had begun to swell and rise. Earth had never been perfectly spherical anyhow. Now Mir was growing bulges like lumps of mud stuck to the side of a spinning top. In time, the crust and upper mantle would shear off the planet's core, and the deformed planet would seek a new stability by shifting the lumps away from the axis of rotation. As the major continents slid to the equator, ocean currents would be altered again, sea levels raised or lowered by hundreds of meters, dramatic climate changes induced. In Mir's long thonic annealing, there would be difficult times for the planet's cargo of life. But people were mobile. The citizens of Chicago were already preparing for a vast migration south. Many humans would survive, as would the man-apes. Grasper was not as she had been before her inspection by the eye. The probing of her body and mind had been meant only to record her capabilities, to note her place in the great spectrum of possibilities that was life on this blue world. But Grasper was very young, and the machinery that had studied her was very old, and no longer quite so perfect as it had once been. The probing had been clumsy. Grasper's half-formed mind had been stirred. This patched-together world would be dominated for a long time by the humans. There could be no doubt about that. But even they could not defy the ice. On a shifting, dangerous world, there was plenty of empty space to explore. Plenty of room for a creature with potential. And there was no particular reason why that potential had to be realized exactly as it had been before. There was room on Mir for something different. Something better, perhaps. Grasper hefted the heavy stone in her hand and dimly imagined what might be done with it. She was quite without fear. Now she was master of the world, and she was not quite sure what to do next. But she would think of something. 47. Return. Isessa gasped, staggered. She was standing. Music was playing. She stared at a wall, which showed the magnified image of an impossibly beautiful young man crooning into an old-fashioned microphone. Impossible, yes. He was a synth star, a distillation of the inchoate longings of pre-teen girls. My God, he looks like Alexander the Great. Isessa could barely take her eyes off the wall's moving colors, its brightness. She had never realized how drab and dun-colored Mir had been. The soft wall said, "Good morning, Isessa. This is your regular alarm call. Breakfast is waiting downstairs. The news headlines today are..." "Shut up." Her voice was a dusty desert croak. "Of course." The synthetic boy sang on softly. She glanced around. This was her bedroom, in her London apartment. It seemed small, cluttered. The bed was big, soft, not slept in. She walked to the window. Her military-issue boots were heavy on the carpet and left footprints of crimson dust. The sky was grey on the cusp of sunrise, and the skyline of London was emerging from the flatness of silhouette. "Wall, Isessa. What's the date?"
"Tuesday."
"The date? Ah, the 9th of June, 2037. The day after the chopper crash."
"I should be in Afghanistan."
The soft wall coughed.
"I've grown used to your sudden changes of plans, Isessa. I remember once..."
"Mum?" The voice was small, sleepy. Isessa turned. She was barefoot, her tummy stuck out, fist rubbing at one eye, hair tousled, a barely awake 8-year-old. She was wearing her favorite pajamas, the ones across which cartoon characters gambled, even though they were now about 2 sizes too small for her.
You didn't say you were coming home.
Something broke inside Bessessa. She reached out.
Oh, Myra.
Myra recoiled.
You smelled funny.
Shocked, Bessessa glanced down at herself. In her orange jumpsuit, scuffed and torn and coated with sweat-soaked sand, she was as out of place in this 21st century flat as if she had been wearing a space suit. She forced a smile.
I guess I need a shower. Then we'll have breakfast and I'll tell you all about it.
The light changed subtly. She turned to the window. There was an eye over the city, floating like a barrage balloon. She couldn't tell how far away it was, or how big. And over the rooftops of London, a baleful sun was rising. End of Time's Eye, A Time Odyssey, Book 1, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter.